Hello and welcome to another Tea with Nettie. My guest today is our principal oboist on Baroque oboe, Katharina Spreckelsen, and she talks about how she came over from Germany and had lessons and established her career in the UK. For some reason, I seem to have forgotten to ask her about the oboe d'amore and the oboe da caccia, but I think she's done several videos which you could look at. And you can hear her in all her glory playing in the Christmas Oratorio with Masaaki Suzuki, which will be coming up in November. And I hope you'll enjoy it.
Tea with Nettie.
Katharina, hello. Thank you so much for agreeing to Zoom with me from what looks like a very cosy study. Is that your study you're in?
It's Andrew's study.
It's wonderful for me to actually have an oboist to talk to, because I don't think I've talked to an oboist on Tea with Nettie. And a lot of things are quite a mystery to me. For instance, reed making. That is a very frightening concept. I mean, it's bad enough trying to put a string on, but making a reed to play on must be a real problem.
I have to say that doesn't bode well for the interview, that this is the first question, because reeds is not my favourite subject to talk about. But I'll have a go. Reeds are a pain. I'm not very good at it, I have to say. I'm not very good at reed making. And actually, when I started studying with Paul Goodwin, one of the first things he said to me was, you've got to get good at playing on bad reeds. He had already got the measure of me. But, you know, I have persevered and I think I got a bit better at it now.
Well, it always sounds wonderful. I mean, I'm not sure I'd be able to tell if an oboist was playing on a bad reed or not, really. How would one know?
I think you would know.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. And getting into the world of reeds and oboes, can you remember the first time that you were inspired to actually take up the oboe?
Yeah, I can. And that's a very, very clear memory from my childhood. When I was about 4 or 5, my parents started to take us all, I'm the youngest of 4 children, with our instruments on Christmas Eve to midnight mass. And there was a tradition that the chorales of Bach's Christmas Oratorio would be performed as part of the sermon. And in the sermon, the vicar would read the Christmas story and interspersed with the chorales as they happen in Bach's Christmas Oratorio. So that was my first memory. All of us packing into our Renault 4, which my father said it's the only car that will fit 3 cellos. So we always had Renault 4s as long as I can think. Yeah. And so we performed the Christmas Oratorio. And only later on, I then realized how much more music there was to the Christmas Oratorio, because obviously we only performed the chorales. From that memory, the chorales still are, for me, the sort of anchor pieces of this work. But coming back to the oboe is very busy in the Christmas Oratorio. And that is, I think, when I first listened to Arnoncourt's recording at home, that I thought, gosh, that instrument, I've got to play that, because it gets all these lovely arias to play. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And actually to have been introduced to the Christmas Oratorio at such a young age, imbibed along with learning languages and everything, that is a fantastic start. And what a wonderful way to be introduced to the oboe. I shouldn't think there are many people that have been introduced to the oboe like that.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I didn't start playing the oboe when I was 5. I carried on for a few more Christmases to play on my recorders. Mm-hmm. But then when I was, I think, 10 or 11, must have been my first Christmas where I was allowed to join in, probably pretty squeaky, but I was allowed to play in a few of the chorales.
Oh, fantastic. And do you remember feeling very excited when they first said you were allowed to do that?
on your...
Oh, yeah. Because it felt, no disrespect to the recorder, which I think is a wonderful instrument, but I felt like now I was playing a real orchestral instrument and I was part of the gang.
Yes. Oh, fantastic. And so then, while you were at school, you carried on, did you, with the oboe?
I did. And I played in school orchestra and played chamber music and played lots of lovely music. Actually, another thing that I was really lucky to be introduced to was that when I was, I think I must have been about 15 in 1985, that the Kasseler Staatstheater put on Lully's Phaeton. And my oboe teacher was the principal oboist of the Staatstheater Orchestra in Kassel. And they needed four oboes and also somebody who could play recorder. So he took me along and I was allowed to actually do the run of Phaeton, which was directed by Herbert Wernicke, who in Germany is a very, very famous opera director. And yeah, it was just an amazing experience to sit in the pit and play this extraordinary music. So yeah, I was lucky, very lucky.
And it, was it at that stage that you really, really decided you wanted to do that for the rest of your life, or for a living anyway?
No, in fact, I really didn't. Not because I didn't love it, but my grandfather was a pianist and a conductor, and my aunt was actually a soprano. And I think maybe they put me off, or that put me off a little bit. I just thought, I want to keep music as my hobby. I wanted to be sort of the pleasure on the side. And I'd seen it with my parents, how well that worked. Neither of them musicians, but loved music, and music was a big, big part of their lives always. So I went to Göttingen University to study medicine, but then realized what I didn't have, and that was playing the oboe regularly, because however much I loved it at university and I loved the learning, anything connected with medicine, but I did spend an awful long time on the train traveling to Cologne from Göttingen. In those days, the east-west connections weren't very good. And to have oboe lessons there with the wonderful late Helmut Hooker, who was one of the most generous and wonderful oboists that I've ever met. Mm. Yeah.
And being in Göttingen, there's a famous Handel Festival there, isn't there, in Göttingen?
Yes. And well, again, third time lucky that when it came to the end of my second year at university, that summer, Nicholas McGeegan was performing Handel's Agrippina, and their fourth oboe had dropped out at very last minute. And I was asked to step in. So that summer, I should have been studying very, very hard and doing a placement in hospital, and I didn't. I played, and I think that was then.
Agrippina happened to be the first Handel opera I ever played in, with really? Kent Opera, conducted by Ivan Fischer. And I do remember that the first oboe part was fearsome, even in the overture.
Yeah,
really, extremely active.
Very active. And I tell you, I was very, very glad to be doubling the second oboe.
I can imagine. Yes. Just something you said earlier, this is a complete non sequitur, but you saying that a Renault 4 was the only car that would take three cellos. I'm sure people must be wondering how, because the Renault 4 it's tall, but not that wide, is it?
No, but it's tall. And I think that was it. So if you took the lid of the boot out, you could somehow fit two cellos. There were no hard cases. They were all soft cases. And
yeah,
God knows how these cellos survived. So the boot got two cellos and various. So my father played the flute. So his flute and my recorders, and then the third cello went across. So the four of us sat on the bench at the back, and it sort of went slightly angled across our laps, and I guess the viola went between the knees of the passenger. I guess that's how. So my sister played the viola, both my brothers the cello, and my mother the cello as well.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. And so somehow there's a authenticity in the true sense of the word of you coming from the German tradition of Bach and Telemann and all that, their church music. Everything you're saying makes me think your family sounds as if it had come up or down through the generations doing the same. Would that be fair to say?
I think there are musicians on my father's side, but that music is part of life. That's certainly true. And I remember our summer holidays, which usually went somewhere to the north coast of Germany, because that's where my father was from, that we went to the islands there, and we always stopped at churches. We always stopped. The car would be stopped, all children out, all children into a church and look at it. And at the time, I just wanted to get to the seaside. I wanted to get to the beach. I did not want to sit in an old, cold church. Mm. But now looking back, I'm really glad. And we were taken to lots. And it still happens in these North German churches that they're organ concerts the whole time. You will go to any little church and there'll be, tonight we'll hear some Bruns or Beckmann or any of these wonderful composers, and Buxtehude. And so we would be taken in the evenings when often we might want to do something else or watch telly. We'd be dragged to these concerts. And again, now looking back to it, I am grateful because it introduced me to this amazing music. I'm such a fan of the pre-Bach North German school.
Yes. And actually, one can tell that because you were on our Players Artistic Committee, we were lucky enough to have you doing quite a lot of our programming. And you obviously have an extensive knowledge of particularly Bach, Handel, Telemann, but also Purcell, and so good at programming and just working out what goes with what to make a really good program. Were you involved in programming the Baroque Busters program we've been touring for the last year or two? I thought you might have been. It had your fingerprints on it.
Yeah. That was a different task. That was just finding popular pieces and seeing how they will fit together. And in fact, we made two or three programs for different forces, but I think we happened to have only toured the one program. Mm. But there are a couple of others. I love doing that. But the real programming that I really loved was during lockdown still when we did that. I think you were there with Roddy.
Yes.
We did a nice Bach and Telemann program.
Yes.
But it's sort of easy because people had faith in me that I could just put the music together that I love. And somehow that fits.
Well, there you are.
Somehow others loved it too. And that's great.
It is wonderful when someone asks you to do something and you gain confidence because you think, well, someone thinks I can do it and therefore why don't I have a go at it? I mean, I felt that being asked to do some programming myself, and it's not something I've done a lot of, but it's quite exciting once you start thinking about things.
And it got as far as that we sat 4 years ago on Pack and King's Place. I remember we were sitting round the table and Crispin had this big piece of paper and said, okay, artistic planning now. And we were planning the season 22-23. Mm. It was C. And so we had to find lots of related music. And so all I said was, what about doing something with the Rime of the Ancient Mariner? And so I remember Crispin just writing in the corner, Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And had stayed there, and then lots of other people had suggestions. And then I'd forgotten about it. And then, you know, a year and a half later, Crispin said, okay, that will be the season opener. So what would you like to do with it? And so panic struck. I had thought it had to be Purcell. I knew, although it's not Coleridge contemporary, of course, but because of the language, I felt it just had to be Purcell. And luckily, it fit quite well in the end.
It was fantastic. It's one of the best things we've done. And it was so wonderful to have Rory Kinnear. I mean, he really was fantastic. And he committed the whole thing from memory, didn't he? Yes. And he just had the audience spellbound. I think they were so quiet. Just had to be... Well, actually, Stephen Devine was brilliant at coordinating everything. Yes, we had to be so on the ball, turning our pages very quietly and being ready to go at the right distance from when he just said something and leading into him again. But it was a really exciting thing to do, and it'd be wonderful to do it again.
Yeah, really. It was a really wonderful development as well, because we had one day of rehearsals just for the music, and then on the second rehearsal day, when Rory arrived and I asked him, how would you like us to be? Who would you like us to be in this? Mm-hmm. And you could just tell he just wanted to find his feet. So he was just saying, I think that you're just going to be doing the music thing, and I'll be in front of you and I'll do the words. But within minutes, you could really see he was relaxing into us.
Yes.
And by the end, he took the whole space, didn't he? He interacted with us, that wonderful wedding pasakai at the end, where he was the mariner who's left out from all the celebrations, just walks around us, looking in longingly, wanting to be part of something and not being able to. Yeah. And he did that for the first time when we actually performed it. He'd never done it in rehearsal.
Yes.
He's just such a great actor.
He is
and loves music. He absolutely adores music, and you could tell.
And I suppose you are quite attuned to acting in the theatre, because your husband Andrew, he was an actor, wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, that
Does
was
he still act?
He teaches now, which might be quite similar at times. But he knows Rory well from his acting days, so we were lucky. Lucky.
Yeah, well, sometimes one wonders how much is luck and how much is just trusting that things will be okay in the end. I don't know.
That's true.
It's funny. Destiny. I remember talking to someone else on Tea with Nettie about destiny, and he decided it was about choices. But it seems even the choices one is faced with sometimes are sort of...
Yeah, especially if you ask an actor, because actors' work comes in so late. That I remember Emily Stubbs asking me 2 months before we started, the project happened. She said, have you got the plan B? And I was like, no. I'm really hoping Rory can do it. I mean, the thought that he wouldn't have been able to do it was quite... I mean, I did think about plan Bs, but I'm just glad we... didn't ever need to go there.
Yes, we're very lucky, because although we're self-employed, we do tend to know quite far in advance what we're going to be doing.
Very different to the acting world.
Very different, isn't it? And I think to be self-employed and still with OE have enough idea of what might be happening over at least the next 18 months. That's probably a luxury compared to an actor.
Oh, absolutely.
And that means they hardly have any time to learn things from memory then, doesn't it?
No.
I suppose. Because that's another thing we don't tend to have to do unless someone's a soloist. Well, there are orchestras like the Aurora Orchestra that play from memory, and very effective it is too.
Yeah. But I mean, I remember even when we did the wonderful Peter Sellers, Simon
Rattle, St. John Passion,
I had to memorize a couple of arias and the opening chorus, and well, all four woodwinds had to. And we were given months of warning that would come. So we really had a long time to prepare for that.
Anyway, so you studied, and how did you come to be in England? You came to study here, didn't you? You came to study with Paul Goodwin.
So first I studied for a year in Basel at the Schola with Michel Piguet, which was a great year to have had. And then I went on to study with Paul in London. So I'd met Paul before and had several lessons with him. And it just clicked. And I knew that he was a good teacher for me. He was so extrovert and I was not. And it really helped me a lot along the way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah. And coming to actually live in England, was this a bit of a culture shock, or had you spent so much time visiting England by then that you knew what you were in for?
No, it was just London is so huge. And when I first moved to London, I shared a flat in Finsbury Park, Stoke Newington borders, so nowhere near a tube station, really. So it was a bus ride away from Finsbury Park tube station. And then I studied at the Royal College of Music, which was like the other end of the Piccadilly line. So the way to get there, to leave the house early enough to, and then, you know, things don't work, or it just being so vast. But I found London very exciting, and the possibilities and the concerts I could go and hear. And at the college, I wonder if it still exists, but they were in the library during the time of the proms. Every morning people would pin a few prom tickets on a blackboard there, on a pin board, and we could just take, and it was sort of trusted we wouldn't take them all, but sometimes we'd be really lucky and get a really quite nice seat for a concert. So that was wonderful, actually. No, I really liked it at the college, and of course I was fortunate to be able to join the college rock orchestra,
yes,
which was directed by Cat McIntosh.
Yes.
And that was like the highlight of the week.
Aww.
to do orchestra with her. So encouraging and enthusiastic and full of music. And that was wonderful. And also I got to meet lots of people, because at that time it was really the college that had the biggest early music department, I think. The Guildhall had one too, and so did the Academy, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But the college was the only one with the orchestra. So students from the Academy and from the Guildhall would come and join in. So I got to know lots and lots of other musicians that I wouldn't have met otherwise. And one of which is lovely Alex Bellamy, who came from the Academy. So I met her probably within 2 weeks of me arriving in London in September 1992, and have known and played with her ever since.
Oh, that's really nice. And although you're principal oboe of OAE and she's number two, occasionally you swap round, don't you? I mean, you're so relaxed and respectful of each other. It works either way.
I think it's a good sign. It's a good working relationship, and I respect her so hugely that that's not a problem. Yeah.
I was just thinking when you were saying that always in Northern Germany you go to a church and there's a concert on, the whole attitude to music in Britain is so different, isn't it, coming from the top, from the government, how arts are perceived as being just, or religion for that matter, actually. Everything has become more peripheral to making money or other things, it seems to me.
Yeah, and the importance of music and our development and child's development, how important it is and what a difference one can make to a child's development having music in their lives.
Difference.
It's very, very sad to see that it's just not being taken on board everywhere. Short-sighted, I'd say. Very short-sighted.
Yes, it is really sad. So you studied and you came out of the college, and I'm sure you were immediately in demand. You must have been Paul's star student, were you?
I think I was the only student, really. So top and bottom at the same time. But I was fortunate to come to London at the time I did, because Paul actually within a couple of years stopped playing and stopped teaching and took on his career as a conductor. And so he did introduce me to some orchestras, and I auditioned to a few as well. And so I was very fortunate that at quite a young age of 23, 24, I started playing with a lot of wonderful ensembles, and I met so many amazing instrumentalists and singers. And if I had to single somebody out, it would be the most wonderful James Bowman, who died earlier this year, who I still feel tearful when I just think about him, because he had an enormous influence my whole music life. And I'm sure I'm not the only one. I'm sure a lot of people would say that. His presence was unique, and he was funny and entertaining and very sincere about music too. Working with him for, well, probably about 10 years, but also later on in his life when he was at the Chapel Royal, had, as he called it, his day job, going back, you know, going full circle, going back to joining a choir from where he started at New College as a student. It was just wonderful to hear him, see him on stage doing opera, singing the most beautiful Purcell. In my late 20s, I was really lucky that he asked me to perform William's Blake songs, the 10 Blake songs.
In Snape.
In Aldeburgh. Mm-hmm. And I went to his house beforehand and we had rehearsals, and he just was so patient with me, this German person, and having to be introduced to William Blake and Vaughan Williams. And he did it brilliantly and patiently. And I just loved that working relationship hugely. And I do remember our drive up. a drive up to Aldeburgh. He was driving. He was driving, yeah.
My God, what was his driving like?
I remember it being pretty good. The surprise came when we stopped and he said, now we're going to have breakfast. And we stopped at the Little Chef.
Yes.
And he went to the counter and ordered a cholesterol special, please. He wanted. So there was that, James. Oh, gosh, I could talk about him endlessly.
Oh, well, you can, because, I mean, it's lovely to hear about it. I just remember him being endlessly funny. But as you say, the attention to words and making sure that the audience was absolutely sharing everything that he was doing, that was a real influence. Michael Chance, I know, found that really, really inspiring. And Michael Chance was saying that James was very generous with him and would share a lot with him. But then sometimes he'd say, right, I'm going away now, when they'd be on stage together in the Wigmore Hall or something. And James said, I'm going to have a rest now. You carry on with no warning.
Now, I remember him and Robin Blaise singing a lot together, taking the alto parts and overhearing their hilarious conversations, and James saying to Robin, OK, you do the notes, I do the consonants.
Oh, that's wonderful. Oh, wow. Oh, that was really nice. And then which other groups did you play in from that time?
So the Gabrielli Players for Florilegium. And then around 2000, when the big Bach year hit, I played for both the English Concert and the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra. And so that was a very, very busy year, 3-week tours back to back with cantatas, Matthew Passion, the suites, Brandenburg concertos, and wonderful tours with Trevor Pinnock doing the orchestral suites and the Brandenburgs. Absolutely wonderful. I loved playing those with him.
Yes, that must have been fantastic. Yes, Bach. That was the year that I was involved in Sir John Eliot Gardiner's Bach Cantata Pilgrimage.
Yeah.
And we were immersed in Bach as well. Yes. Wonderful way to enter the new millennium.
Yeah, absolutely. Wonderful. And then with Ton, of course, as well.
Ton Koopman with the Amsterdam.
We did a lot of cantatas and yeah, Matthew Passions that year was a big tour. Yeah, so it was, as you say, a wonderful start to the new millennium with a lot of Bach. And I stayed with Ton Koopman for quite a long time, really until our second child arrived. And then that made just being away for such long times, and rehearsals being in Amsterdam as well. So even for the rehearsals, one had to be away from home. That was just too much. So that was not sustainable.
Yes. Well, I remember you did tell me at one time with the Gabrielli consort and players that Paul McCreech used to dedicate his own dressing room to you and Freddie, your first.
Yeah, that was when Freddie was 4 months old.
Wow.
I took him on a tour of North Sweden in March.
Mm.
Wherever we arrived, Paul would take the sign off his dressing room where it says the McCreech, and he would replace it with a sign saying Mini Maestro, which was Freddie.
Really
so
nice.
He was really, really kind and made that tour possible. But I do remember a tour taking my second son, Joseph, on tour with Trevor Pinnock and coming back to my room late at night where actually my mother had been looking after Joseph, and I tiptoed in my room, didn't dare to put the light on. Joseph must have been about 6 months old, and brushed my teeth in the dark and just went to sleep and woke up in the middle of the night thinking, what is this sticking to my cheek? And as I felt it, I realized it was the welcome chocolate that had been left on the pillow, and it was stuck to my cheek. And I just thought, this is where the glamour ends. The welcome chocolate on the cheek.
Oh, poor you. The pillow must have looked appalling.
Yeah, I think so.
But luckily,
I think that was probably the last tour I took.
That was the last straw as well as the last tour. Yeah. Oh, and then, of course, you've made lots of recordings, haven't you, of the oboe repertoire. I do remember you in one of our Baroque Busters programmes telling the audience that you'd recorded the Albinoni concerto 3 times and one was to be played in a lift or something. Did I get that right?
It was just the slow movement. I've never recorded it in its entirety, but the slow movement was, once for a Lars von Trier movie, Dogville.
All right.
And the other one was the CD that was recorded for music played in lifts. And popular music that people like.
Yes.
So, a good choice.
Well, I suppose it is a good choice. I mean, one does wonder who chooses these things. I mean, British Airways, their choice of music, the sort of things they play, Dvorak, Serenade, and...
But
that's just me. But I mean, dribbly music you're forced to listen to when you're hanging on the phone waiting to get through to somebody about tax or something like that. It's just... wonder if someone has actually chosen that music.
Yeah.
Even if you're at the airport, even if you're going to the ladies' loo, there's somebody, some poor person has recorded the Beethoven violin concerto and you're in the loo and this is playing. You think, I wonder if the person playing the concerto knew where it ended up.
Yeah.
But maybe I shouldn't have gone there early. Anyway, that's just something that occurred to me. But have you recorded the Brandenburgs 2 or 3 times now?
No, the Brandenburgs I've only recorded once. The Matthew Passion, I think I've recorded 3 times.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's probably the one that I've done the most. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've slightly lost track, but a lot of Bach cantatas. The reason why I'm saying losing track is that the way Ton Koopman recorded them was often one day lots of oboe arias with soprano, then the next day would be lots of violin arias with other voice. Or so it's still sometimes surprising when I hear it and I think, ah, this is where it's from.
Must have been exhausting to record a whole day of oboe arias.
Yeah, it was.
I can see the logistics would make sense to him, but oh my goodness, for you.
Yeah, but lovely Ton never gets tired. And I think he never really quite understood that others might. But that was part of the fun as well, actually, with him. The energy was just extraordinary.
True. And if he noticed any players wilting, he'd just say, coffee, he'd say,
everything. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, he was very kind to us too, but we just had to get on with it.
Yes. And was his wife producing the recording at that time? Was Teenie?
Yes, Teenie. Yes. Yeah, she was. She was very much so. Yeah. But you know that. I mean, you've been there, haven't you?
I've been there. In fact, I think the only time she wasn't producing was quite funny, actually, because they were recording the Bach double concerti. Do you say concerti or concertos? I think probably concerti. And I remember between them, they did so many trills. The harpsichords were shaking. Everything was shaking. They sounded, well, Jan and I, we were really naughty, but it sounded a bit like a special milk delivery going over a level crossing or something.
That's a good image.
It was fun.
Trills featured heavily, didn't they?
They did. He really loved his trills. Well, there's a thought. Yes, and so you didn't miss your having done your 2 years of medical studies. That you didn't have any regrets about abandoning that, did you?
Not at first. I think there's a little bit in me that wonders what if. I notice the older I get, the more I notice how much I love learning. Mm-hmm. And I love learning now, but I think I always have. And I think medicine suited that quite well. There was so much to learn, and I was quite excited about that in a slightly nerdy way. But I found a sort of outlet for that as well in my maths. I really love maths. And having witnessed both my parents, my father was a physicist, my mother was a maths and chemistry teacher, and both of them in older age, when they were both retired, tutored maths. Mm. And in the end, absolutely lovely, they're tutored together because neither of them was quite confident enough to do it on their own. So the ratio was two tutors to one student. But it has just shown me how important it is to just keep learning, keep doing it, keep interacting with people. And I think teaching is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Yeah. And I love teaching my oboe pupils too. And it's more and more becoming a big part of my life is teaching.
Yes, I found it a very learning experience, actually, teaching. I think I've learned some of the most profound things through seeing other people do thinking of solutions for them with them, actually.
Absolutely.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
It's so much easier to see in someone else than trying to get outside oneself and see how to improve on one's own.
Yeah, and how do we communicate it?
Yes.
So I'm doing a degree course at the Open University, which is called Mathematics and Its Learning. And it doesn't give you a teaching diploma at the end, but it's a maths degree. But the last three modules, which I'm right at the end now, are focusing on how do we communicate geometry? How do we communicate with a learner, with a friend, with a skeptic? How do we communicate about algebra? How do we talk about it? And I find that fascinating. That makes me sound like such a nerd, but I really find it fascinating. And that could be about anything. It could be about literature and
it could.
Music. And how do we talk about it?
remember I didn't have very good maths lessons, but I do remember feeling very upset because when I was young, I could do mental arithmetic really, really well. But when it came to writing things down, I could hold things so well in my head, but I never managed to write it down in a way that satisfied the teacher. So if I got the right answer, but without being able to show how I'd done it, she assumed I'd copied it from someone else. And it completely put me off. And I just sort of more or less gave up trying because I used to be able to do it. But on the other hand, I suppose on some level, it really stood me in good stead for reading and counting music, particularly some of the more complicated things. So it wasn't a waste. And you love to learn, and I hate to forget, but I find I'm forgetting more and more as I go along.
Oh, so do I. So do I.
I don't believe that. Well, it's been really great to talk to you. Thank you so much for sparing the time.
Not at all. Thank you for having me. It's a real honour. ¶¶